Construction meets the world's most popular board game in new Monopoly Construction Edition. Amass or possibly lose great fortunes. Every space on the board is packed with both iconic construction brands and incredible infrastructure projects in this new exciting edition of Monopoly. You'll need to make smart decisions to come out on top. Have you got what it takes to succeed in the world of construction? Search Construction Monopoly to order now.
It's Wednesday the 25th of November and you're listening to Reconstruction, the weekly podcast from the Construction Index. I'm David Taylor, editor of the Construction Index magazine, and with me as usual is Phil Bishop, editor of our daily online news service. Morning, Phil.
Morning, David. Hello.
How are you?
I'm doing well. I'm looking forward. We're speaking before the Chancellor, Rishi Sunak, stands up and tells the House of Commons the autumn statement, his spending plans for the year or more ahead, and unveils the National Infrastructure Strategy, which we've been waiting for a long time, long overdue publication, which will be full of stuff for us to talk about, but we can't talk about that today because we haven't heard it yet, so we'll have to save that
for next week. You say that, but I've already started getting press releases from various industry organisations reacting to his announcements, and he hasn't said anything yet. So
I've not seen those yet. We welcome any money he's going to give us. That's what
they say, indeed.
Is it?
Yeah.
But it's a missed opportunity because he could have given us even more money.
Anyway, okay, so we'll save that for next week. But for this week...
We should talk about this week. Well, before we talk about this week, can I just add a coda to our last week's conversation? If you remember last week, we talked about the Stonehenge Tunnel and the Lower Thames Crossing and a tunnel under the Thames in the sort of Gravesend, Ebbsfleet, neck of the woods to the east of the Dartford Tunnel and Dartford Bridge. And that's been in the news again since we last spoke. Interestingly, strangely, Highways England has withdrawn its planning application for the Lower Thames crossing. It's a temporary measure. It hasn't dropped the plan altogether, but it has to, for big projects like this, they need something called a development consent order, which the Secretary of State for Transport has to sign off. And the planning process involves the planning inspectorate looking at it and having an inquiry and studying it and everything. And the first thing the planning inspectorate does, it looks at the application and goes, okay, we approve your application, well, we approve your submission, you know, your application for permission, that we will consider it now. And planning inspectorate's first reaction, when we looked at the paperwork that Highways England submitted, said, well, you've not done your homework properly here. You've not sent everything in that you need to send in, and half the stuff's been redacted. We want to see workings out.
Yeah.
So they had a chat about it, and Highways England submitted that, and they had a chat about it, and then a week later, Highways England said, "Hang on a minute, we'll withdraw the application." It sounds like there's going to be lots of chatting behind the scenes as to exactly what Highways England... You would have thought Highways England would know how to submit one of these applications.
I've done it before.
But anyway, that is... It's a setback for the planning of the project. I don't know whether it's going to mean the start of construction is going to be pushed back at all. They were hoping to start on mid-2022. Don't know whether that's going to be still doable. We'll have to see what happens.
But they only put in the application in October, didn't they?
No, Small delay. Not even that. Sorry, yes, end of October, 23rd of October they put it in. Yes, yeah.
So maybe just a hiccup.
I'm sure it is, but, you know, hiccups can turn into burps.
Yeah.
Can they? I don't know.
The irony of it is, that as you mentioned, last week we were also talking about the Stonehenge Tunnel. To great fanfare, the government announced that it was going to go ahead with that and it gave it its blessing. And that was completely rejected by the planning inspectorate. They didn't like that at all, did they?
But we talked about this last week. It wasn't completely rejected. The bottom line, at the end of the day, it came down against it, but it said there's an awful lot going for it. But interestingly, we talked last week about how we thought archaeologists might be, you know, concerned about digging up the tunnels through the World Heritage Site there. But there was a letter in the, I think it was the Times, signed by all kinds of archaeologists and academics and important people saying, actually, we're on Highways England's side here. We think they've, you know, The tunnel is a good thing. It's a good solution. We're happy. So that's quite interesting.
Yes,
there are people on that side of the fence who are in favour of it.
Hmm. Okay. Well, enough tunnels. We did that last week. Let's move on.
What have you been up to this week? What have you been doing?
What have I been doing? Well, I don't go to press conferences very often these days because, well, A, I work from home, and B, going to press conference isn't really encouraged under the lockdown conditions. But JCB, our leading plant manufacturer, every year they tend to roll out their latest machines. It's a never-ending R&D operation up there in Roaster. They usually have a big press day for the International Trade Press up at Roaster, and it's quite a big affair because you usually go up the day before, you're given dinner, you're put up at a hotel, and then the next day you go out to the headquarters. They've got a proper theatre there, fully equipped theatre.
A museum as well, I think, haven't they, in Roaster?
I didn't know they had a museum. Didn't know that. I've never seen the museum. But they've certainly got this theatre, which is fully equipped. And they put on this big presentation. It is a bit over the top sometimes. A lot of dry ice, very loud music. And then, you know, somebody wheels an engine onto the stage or something like that. There's a bit of an anticlimax. But
anyone who's seen a JCB Dancing Digger show at Bauma or ConExpo or something will be familiar with the razzmatazz that they put into these
things. Yes, and they certainly do that. They put on a good show if Dancing Diggers is your bag. But anyway, so normally they get this big event. So you go to the theatre after having, you know, sort of been put up in a posh hotel the night before. You have the presentations, and then you all get in buses and troop off to the JCB proving ground to see these machines being put through their paces. And the rest of the day is spent kicking tyres and all that sort of thing. And then they send you off with a little goodie bag and pleased for you to write loads of flattering copy about them. You know, usually it is worth reporting because JCB is one of our leading plant manufacturers, and usually when they're unveiling a new machine, it's usually worth talking about. Anyway, they did that this year, but of course, they couldn't do it the way they normally did it.
Couldn't do it live, could you?
No, they didn't do it live. It was a virtual press conference. So I thought I'd tell you first of all about the machines, get that bit out of the way. The whole thing was about alternative fuel systems, but mainly battery power. It's got this mini excavator, which is the 19C-1E electric mini excavator, launched in 2018. Had that for a while then. They recently, back in July, I think, they launched a little walk-behind mini dumper, which was also battery powered. But this event, there were three main products which were on show, and they were quite significant because one was the first all-electric JCB load-all telehandler. It was called the 525/60E, and of course it is the electric version of the 525/60, which is a diesel-powered machine. It's exactly the same. It's got exactly the same performance, same lift height, 6 meters. It can lift, I think it's 2,500 kilograms. But but inside it's different because instead of a diesel engine, it's got a couple of electric motors and a big lithium ion 96 volt lithium ion battery.
Do you need a diesel generator to charge the battery?
Well, this is one of the things because, of course, you do need electric power to charge a battery. And very often, if you're on a building site, you don't have mains electricity, especially if you're doing the initial enabling works. So one of the other machines, or one of the other products which was on show, was this universal charger. So JCB has developed this universal charger, which is like a sort of a little, I don't know, it's like a little sort of obelisk which sits by the side of the site that is linked into the mains, and that provides you with a rapid charge. I think it can charge this load all in about 2 hours.
But you're assuming you've got mains again, aren't you? Or they are?
Well, this is, yes. Well, I will come on to that because that is significant. This universal charger, it works for all of JCB's emerging E-Tech range. So, I mean, the E-Tech range, I think you've got the mini excavator, you've got the little walk-behind dumper, you've got a battery pack. Not quite sure about that one because that wasn't mentioned much in this press conference. You have the new load-all. You also have one of the other new machines which was launched at this virtual event was a new one-ton dumper. This is a proper site dumper. It's called the 1T-E, of course.
A sit-on one.
A sit-on one, yeah.
A ride-on
one. Yeah, it's quite small. It's just a one-ton dumper, but it's a ride-on one. It hasn't got a cab because it's too small for that, but it's got a ROPS bar going over the top. Very useful machine, and the perfect complement, we're told, to the 19C stroke 1E electric mini excavator. So you've got a nice little combination there. So, but all these machines can be charged from this new universal charger, and apparently it's very, very quick. You can top it up at lunchtime. It takes about 30 minutes just to top the battery up using this rapid charger. And I think I'm not quite sure about this, but I think that it will charge all of these machines in about 2 hours from flat to 100%. So that's pretty good.
That's pretty impressive. They're normally overnight chargers, aren't they, if you plug them into the mains?
Yes, but this is a universal fast charger. So, I mean, if I've mistaken that, and I will look at my figures later, but I'm sure JCB will correct me if I'm wrong. But it's quite good, and of course JCB are very enthusiastic about this. They say that they are committed to zero emissions. In fact, the phrase 100% electric zero emissions was trotted out at every opportunity, really driving the message home. So they are really committed to this sort of drive towards electric power. I mean, they're not giving up on diesel. JCB are very careful to say they're not giving up on diesel yet, because obviously they've got a much larger range. And they do say that as they roll out the E-Tech range, you're going to see more machines at the lower end, the mini end of the product range. Although we are told by Tim Bernhope, who's their sort of chief innovation officer, to watch this space. So there will be other developments, and possibly some larger machines as well, but most of the ones, certainly in the foreseeable future, will be at the lower end of the range.
Did they talk about, they've got a hydrogen-powered prototype excavator.
That's right, which is actually
interesting, because Bamford Jr., is it Joe Bamford, the son?
Yeah.
He used to work for JCB, and he left not so long ago to set up this hydrogen power company, and he's bought a bus manufacturer.
We've
talked about this before.
Yeah.
Hydrogen power buses. So he's at the forefront of the hydrogen revolution, which may or may not be on its way. But did JCB talk about their hydrogen prototype?
They did indeed. Not in any great detail, because they've launched that prototype, and it is only a prototype. They haven't gone into production with it. So that wasn't the focus of this particular event, but it was mentioned. And in fact, I think it was Tim Bernhope did say that the drive towards hydrogen fuel cells is being driven very enthusiastically by Lord Bamford himself. He's a clear convert to the cause. But there was
understanding is that the theology of all of this is that you are either in the lithium ion camp or the hydrogen fuel cell camp, it seems to me. And I wondered whether, is JCB hedging its bets being in both camps at the moment?
I think it's definitely hedging its bets, because
it tends to favour one source over the other.
No, I mean, I wasn't aware that there were two camps. I hadn't realised that there was that sort of separation. JCB certainly, have a foot in both camps. They're clearly way ahead with the electric stuff compared with the hydrogen stuff, but they are quite committed to the hydrogen stuff. And in fact, the point was made, you mentioned that the problem with having electric machines on site is that you need to charge them, therefore you need electric power, which, if it isn't mains and is diesel, doesn't really make much sense. They did make the point that they have high hopes for hydrogen fuel cells because of the nature of the work that their machines do, going on sites, digging up earth, and very often being away from a mains electricity supply. Hydrogen isn't like that. You can bring hydrogen to a site in a Bowser just like you would diesel. So you don't need the electric supply there. So hydrogen fuel cells, they think, has a lot of potential. So they're definitely hedging their bets. As I said earlier, they haven't given up on diesel. They talk about clean diesel quite a lot. And so I think that they're really spreading themselves fairly broadly in order to sort of keep abreast of developments and keep ahead of them if they can. So it was quite interesting to see these machines. It's clearly a step forward for them. They're committed to developing this E-Tech range, so we will see some more machines come out. And when you think about the JCB range, there's plenty of machines out there that they could easily convert to electric. So these machines are direct electric equivalents to the existing diesel models. So I'm sure that we'll see more. It can't be that difficult for them to keep rolling them out, I would have thought.
Now, a year ago, of course, you would have been kicking the tires and perhaps even having a go operating these machines and, you know, touching them and feeling them. Yeah. This year, you just had to look at videos of them. So you don't, until you actually see the machine, you don't really know how roughly tufty and fab it is. But how did it go down? What was it like being in a virtual press conference?
It was really good because all the presentations, all the stuff that you would have seen in the theatre, they'd all been pre-recorded, so they were very slick. There's no messing about. There's no umming and ahhing. It was just all presented very quickly, very efficiently, all recorded in the theatre. It was still done in the theatre there. And it was followed up by a sort of a live Q&A session. So after they'd run the presentations, the team, there were four guys there who did the presentations, they all appeared live on the stage, socially distanced, and did a live Q&A. But the questions, you had to submit your question by email. And they had a moderator there who was bringing up the questions on his tablet computer as they came through. And there were loads, you could see on the screen that there were loads of questions just pouring in, and he could just cherry pick the questions.
That's a more efficient way of doing it, isn't it? Instead of having to listen to, well, this is it, because what normally happens,
you get some boring digger spotter who knows all about the breakout forces and the litres per minute of each hydraulic pump and everything like that, just basically showing off. I was at a press conference at JCB once and sitting in one of these Q&A sessions, and the person sitting next to me, who I shan't mention, but she did make a very good point. She said these people have absolutely no interest in what these machines are actually designed and built for. You know, nobody asks questions about how these machines can enhance the construction process or speed up progress on site or anything like that. They're all completely obsessed with the arcane technicalities of the machine, and it's a bit like a sort of a, what's that Jeremy Clarkson program that he,
well, I was gonna say, I have this problem with Top Gear and motoring shows. They review these sort of £250,000 cars that I'm probably never going to see, never going to own or drive, and I've got really next to no interest in what the new Bugatti Veyron or whatever it's called can do. What I want to know is which is the best car to get three old Labradors into.
Yeah.
That's all I want to know.
Yeah, you're
don't
right.
Don't even have Labradors.
You're
Spaniels,
absolutely right. But yeah, so to put it in a nutshell, these press conferences often get dominated by diesel-powered train spotters, basically, who are just there for the thrill of seeing a big bit of yellow metal being driven around a proving site. So there was none of that. I mean, there was obviously no visit to the proving site, so you couldn't see them going through their motions. But it was very efficient. I did ask a question, but it wasn't answered. So clearly it wasn't considered to be an important question. But the question was, just in case anybody wanted to know, was whether or not these diesel equivalents, you know, as I said, all these electric machines have direct pre-existing diesel equivalents, whether or not these would be taken out of production now that we've got electric versions, or if they were going to be kept in production, for how long they would be kept in production, and whether or not they'd be phased out. So I still don't know the answer to that one, I'm afraid. There are lots of other very apposite questions asked.
And presumably for JCB to do this online rather than having to put everyone up in hotels and feed them and entertain them and so on, it must have saved them a packet. And I'd imagine also, I mean, how many people do they normally get? 50 or 100 journalists from around the place?
Probably something like that. Well, at the end of the thing, Graham McDonald came on, the company's chief executive. He came on to thank everybody for attending. He was clearly very pleased with the way things had gone, because he he first of all gave a summary of how things are at JCB. He says that they're doing really well at the moment, all things considered. Every market that they serve has rebounded, he said, from the COVID, the initial COVID shock. They're seeing better machine sales and utilization now, so things are improving from that point of view. He says that he expects between 5 and 8% sales growth next year, which is obviously good.
Worldwide or UK, is he talking?
Ah, don't know. I think he was talking worldwide, but I can't be sure of that. My notes just said 5 to 8% growth.
It's interesting they're so bullish, because while we know that we talked about the UK market being resilient, I guess is the word, India is a big part of the JCB story.
Yeah.
And Severfield, the structural steel company, the contractor, put out its half-year results the other day, showing extraordinary growth overall because of its big growth in the UK. Profits were down a bit, but I think it had something like 40% rise in sales compared to last year for the 6 months, April to September, and which is remarkable. But the story was not the same for their joint venture in India. They said in India, it's been a whole different story. There's been a real shutdown of work and slowdown, and everything's gone backwards in India because of COVID. There's been a different market reaction. I would have imagined if it's hitting a steelwork contractor, it would hit the machinery manufacturers too.
You'd think so.
And most of JCB's, I was going to say most of its growth, but certainly what's made JCB the phenomenon that it is has been on the back of its India success story.
Yes. Yeah, well, that's true. I think that probably Graham McDonald was talking internationally when he said that, because he said straight afterwards that everybody, not just the UK, is, you know, using infrastructure to build back. I imagine that's an allusion to his international markets. And that, I don't know whether or not he didn't mention any of them specifically. But he seems to think that things are looking pretty rosy for JCB next year. And I think that he's probably talking in the, not just about the UK, but his other markets as well. And from the, as you said, from the point of view of whether or not holding a virtual event like this can really achieve what could be achieved by doing it in person, by having flying people in, because there are people from all over the world there. They weren't just UK-based journalists there. It was their first ever virtual press conference. He said it was a great success. They had 250 delegates, and that apparently is roughly twice what they'd normally expect to attend. So, you know, they've saved all that money from not having to fly people in, not having to put them up in a hotel, not having to feed them, and they've got twice as many people there. Presumably, they'll get more than twice the coverage as well.
And do you think that money saved will be passed on to the customers?
You better ask Mr. McDonald that, I think. Because
moving on?
Yeah, I think so. Yeah, we're staying with plant, aren't we, Phil?
Because yes, I would like to talk about something that actually our colleague Lisa Russell wrote this story yesterday, which is a fascinating one. Plant owners are the higher company bosses in the main. There is a body of them which is concerned that operators, machinery operators who are found to have been consuming alcohol or taking drugs in the workplace, or are operating machinery under the influence of alcohol or drugs, they may be sent home, dismissed from that particular job, but they don't lose their, whether it's their CPCS, which is the Construction Plant Competence Scheme card, or their NPORS card, National Plant Operators Registration Scheme, their ticket to operate. They still keep their licence, in effect.
Yes.
And they think that if you're a machinery operator who's found to have been doing drugs or drunk on the job, you should lose your licence. I think, okay, I'm quite surprising that that doesn't happen. It's quite common this day and age individuals have a duty not to operate machinery under the influence of substances that will impair their ability to operate them properly.
Yeah.
And employers have a duty to police to prevent that happening.
Yeah.
So at first sight, you think, well, yeah, this is good. And it's an initiative from the Scottish Plant Owners Association. Yes, yeah. They're trying to get support from... They've had meetings with the people who run the NPAWS scheme and the CPCS scheme, which are the two major card schemes. And they've got some support from them for the proposals, or say full support for the proposals. And they're now trying to get all the other construction industry organisations who have an interest in plant, whether that's the Health and Safety Executive, the Civil Engineering Contractors Association, the Construction Plant Hire Association, Federation of Demolition Contractors, Piling Specialists, Home Builders Federations, all these federation associations to say, you're involved in these card registration schemes, these operator licensing schemes. Come on board and let's get the rules changed so that a machinery operator who has been drinking or doing drugs on the job, get them out of the game, get rid of them, not just from that site for that day, but take away their license to trade.
It's fair enough, isn't it? Nobody wants a drunken digger driver on their site, do they?
I am not for a minute advocating anyone in the workplace, with a possible exception of Keith Floyd, drinking on the job. But there are three things to note about, I mean, the whole machinery operator card licensing or card certification schemes is always controversial. It's always a minefield.
Yes.
But I want to make three points about them. First of all, we're not talking about a driving license here. The CPCS or the NPAWS card is it's a certificate. It's more like an A-level. You've sat your A-level, you've sat your digger driving A-level and said, yep, you're competent. Here's your card that says that you're competent. Now, it does, unlike an A-level, it does have to be, you know, renewed every, I think it's 5 years, and there's an ongoing element. But if the person is competent when they're sober or not under drugs, they're competent, and their competence is not under question. It's their unrelated behaviour that's being called into question. Just as like, you know, you wouldn't take away their competence card if they did some other appalling thing, which would mean you wouldn't want them on site, like, you know, bullying or worse. Some other reason why you want to get rid of them. That doesn't mean, say, they're not a competent operator, that it's not a competent operator when they've been doing the wrong things they've been doing. Point two, people get to keep their driving licenses when they've been prosecuted for drunk driving on the cars on the road, where they can demonstrate that to lose their license would result in particular economic hardship, that their economic welfare depends on their ability to drive for their business or for their work. Now, clearly, if someone's trade is a heavy machinery operator, a digger driver, a crane operator, crane driver, you take away their license to operate, you're taking away their business. You're saying, off you go down to the job centre. And we don't do that for motorists, so I'm not sure we should expect to do that for machinery operators.
Okay.
My third point is that, okay, if someone's a repeat offender and you've helped them and you've tried to work with them and they've got problems and you still can't get through to them and you still can't do anything to help them, then, okay, maybe we do need a three strikes and you're out kind of thing. But essentially, if someone... In the most cases, if someone is drunk or in drugs while they are at work, knowingly risking their own safety, welfare, economic livelihood, and the safety and welfare of those around them, that strongly indicates that it's not that they are a problem, it's that they have a problem.
Yeah.
And it's the duty of an employer to help that person with that problem that they have. The problem is that most of these operators are self-employed or they're agency people. And so there isn't that kind of paternalist duty of care that operators might have if it was one of their own team. It's just someone who's come on site, smashed things up, trashed the job, lost some money, and let's get rid of them. And then the same person turns up on someone else's job site the other day and the following day in the same state, and bosses get together and say, we had that guy on our site the other day, he was rubbish for us too. And say, why, how come he's allowed to come to our site then? I get that, but I would much rather there was some safety net for people who were having these sort of problems. The Scottish Plant Owners Association to their credit, they did say that while we recognise that there may be other issues facing those in the industry who turn to drugs or alcohols, and we aim to support them wherever we can, this idea of taking the licences away is ultimately about making the industry safer and more professionally. Yes. By working collectively, we can ensure this happens. We get the licences removed. And I sort of get it, but I hope they step up the duty of care before they go down this path.
Well, let me take your third point first. Yes, I know. I mean, especially nowadays, employers do have a duty of care. They take that quite seriously. That if somebody has clearly got some sort of problem, you know, emotional, mental, substance abuse problem, there's a tendency now, and I think this is entirely right, that rather than punish them for it, you first try to help them overcome it. And I think that's, you know, that is the way to go. And it's good that,
I mean,
that's
what the industry is like. Clearly, the very first action is you do get them out of the saddle and off
yes.
the sides if they're in
well,
that
this
state.
Well, this is going to be my second point.
You move them
point.
Away
yes.
from causing any problem.
But if you pointed out, a lot of the people in this industry are self-employed. You know, self-employed owner operator trundles from site to site in his backhoe loader or whatever it might be. The only thing that his client or employer, if you want to call them that, can do if they turn up drunk or high on drugs is to
send
them away. They don't have a duty of care.
No.
So they can't do anything about it. Sorry, mate, it's your problem. It's not our problem. Get off my side. And, you know, so often we hear this phrase, zero tolerance. Every contractor now, you know, you will see signs up on site. We have zero tolerance of alcohol or drug abuse. And if zero tolerance means anything, it means no questions asked. If you are drunk on site or if you are intoxicated by any substance on site and as a result are a danger to yourself or somebody else, you're out. You know, no questions asked, no mitigating circumstances. You can't allow it because, you know, we've mentioned before on this podcast that the construction industry has actually done an awful lot in recent years to improve its health and safety record. And it's only done that by really doubling down on hazardous behaviour. And it is very largely a behavioural thing that causes these problems on site. And, I mean, what could be more hazardous in terms of behaviour than turning up on a building site drunk or high on drugs? So I can perfectly understand that. Going to your first point, which is... Or was it your second point?
My first point is it's not a licence. We have to be.
Yes,
it's not a legal requirement to have a licence. It's just a certificate that employers want to see to say, yeah, I'm competent. I know what I'm doing.
I think you've got a point there because as you say, it's not like a driving licence, which is a legal requirement. You can't get in a car or a van, drive down the road without a valid licence. Whereas you're perfectly entitled to operate an excavator or a backhoe loader or a dumper on a construction site without a CPCS or MPAWS card if you can persuade the operator of the site to employ you. And this is a difference. These operators' cards are discretionary. They've become a sort of a given. For all practical purposes, you won't have a career as a plant operator in the construction industry in this country without one of those cards, because people have basically agreed across the board that that's what's required. So if they do take that away, yes, you won't be able to work. So your livelihood is you know, down the toilet. But, you know, again, you mentioned that if you are caught drink driving, you can plead sort of extenuating circumstances and people will say, well, you know, maybe this guy needs his car in order to, you know, get to work or this, that and the other. And there may be a double standard there because obviously the digger driver needs his digger to get to work. But I'm not sure that you're actually right about that, because I had a look at on the internet about this just last night and looking up the penalties for drunk driving.
They can be severe, but it's up to magistrates to give the penalties they want to give.
But they are severe. Even the least severe The lowest penalty for if you're caught drink driving is an instant ban of between 12 and 16 months.
No, people have managed to appeal. I can't name your name, but my understanding is that people have successfully said that, you know, I employ 35 people, and if I can't drive my car, I'm going to have to shut my business down, and all these people are going to be out of work, and the knock-on effect of what you're doing here is disproportionate. I'll go on a course and whatever, but I need to drive.
Yeah. Well, luckily, I don't have any personal experience of this, so I don't know. And I don't know anybody who has been in this situation, I have to confess. My understanding was that drink driving was considered quite differently from, for example, excessive speeding or other offences which can put points on your licence. The only special reasons I could see for, and this was from my Googling last night, the only extenuating circumstances or possible special reasons for not paying the full penalty. Yeah, well, that was one, yeah. If a driver's drink being laced or spiked without their knowledge,
you could argue that one,
mitigation, yeah. Driving due to an emergency, medical or otherwise, so if, for example, you've had a few and you're over the limit, but somebody
you
has
get
to...
Yeah.
that you need to take them to the hospital. There, you could argue that. I think that you'd have to have a pretty good case for that. And the other third reason, which is, I think, a very pragmatic one, is just driving a very short distance. For example, moving a car a few yards to safety. If your car was out in the street or is in the way of something that was causing a hazard and you just literally backed it 10 feet up into the drive, then you could possibly get away with that. But I couldn't find any examples of...
Well, maybe I'm wrong. I don't know. I think maybe just... people don't get off drink driving for economic necessity or economic hardship.
What this demonstrates, Phil, is that both you and I are very responsible drivers, and that we've never had to explore this area before. I don't know. Maybe, you know, lots of employers have this zero tolerance of drug and alcohol on their sites. The industry has, you know, is adopting that sort of mindset, and I think that that's got to be good.
I mean, clearly, if there are machinery operators who are repeat hazards causing threat to life, limb, and economic success of a project, and in that order, they shouldn't be allowed to operate on site. But I would hope to see when NPAWS and/or CPCS write into their rules that if someone's found you or accused you of being drunk, you lose your card. I would hope that they would write into that a fairly sympathetic, rigorous appeals process. That first of all, that it needs to have been proven that someone has to have failed some sort of test and not just been, you know, an excuse to victimise someone out of the industry. And two, that NPAWS or CPCS, before they take someone's card away, they provide them with whatever pastoral support they can.
Yeah, I think that's fair enough. I'm not quite sure when they talk about a guilty operator losing their license or losing their card, forfeiting their card, are they saying what would be the situation there? Because, I mean, you know, if you're banned from driving for a year, you've still got your license, you just can't use it. But after a year, you can go back and get in your car and drive again. Are they saying that they should forfeit their operator's card? Is this what the SPOA is saying, that they should forfeit their operator's card and then have to go back to square one and re-qualify?
They're not specific. They say either temporarily suspended or permanently revoked. And right. I would imagine that you know, you temporarily suspend it for first offence or just slightly over, or, you know, someone who's perhaps had a skinful the night before and hasn't had enough sleep kind of thing, which is, I imagine, is a much more common thing than any of us dare think about. And then the permanent revocation of the card would be for a more, you know, shooting up in a tower crane cab.
Yeah, exactly. Or if their behaviour has actually caused a problem or an injury on site or something like that, I can understand. I have to say, I think that's reasonable. And I think, you know, certainly a temporary revocation of their card two, 3 months, maybe not long enough to actually, you know, put them completely out of business, but long enough to make life
change their behavior
pretty uncomfortable. Yeah, I think I would be in favor of that. I think that's responsible.
On the subject of digging, a lot of us, it appears, have been in our gardens this summer. Unsurprisingly, yeah. I think a lot of people who have gardens get into their gardens in the summer. That's what gardens are there for. But I was interested to see my observations of British behaviour of 2020, this COVID year, being confirmed or supported by statistics from Builders Merchants Point of Sales. The Builders Merchants Federation publishes monthly and quarterly statistics representing about 80% of GB. I don't think it's Northern Ireland, but mainland Britain, builders merchants. So it's a pretty thorough representation of what are being bought in hardware stores, and whether that's the DIY side or the trade side, it's all there. And the third quarter figures came out this week, which is the quarter July, August, September, which basically means summer. So obviously the second quarter, April, May, June, was the COVID infected, everything was sort of down and slowed down, and then lockdown, we came out of lockdown, people started buying more stuff, both at the consumer level and the trade level of things. What is surprising, or interesting, I say, rather than surprising, they're back to near normal. Q3 sales in 2020, 1% higher than Q3 2019, but there's an extra trading day. So they're pretty much the same as they were last year. What has been the big growers in Q3 compared to last year is landscaping, decking, garden walling, paving and fencing and gates, up by 24%. So nearly a quarter, a 24% rise in these sort of decking, garden walling, paving and fencing and gates sales on last year. Now that says to me what I've been feeling, that we've all been getting outside and saying, right, I want to do something. And maybe I'm on furlough, or I can't go to the pub, or, you know, I can't see my friends. Home improvement time, what am I going to do? And interestingly, people have not been doing in the summer plumbing, or, you know, new bathrooms or new kitchens. They're all down. And this isn't down because it's summer. This is down on 2019 figures. Summer of 2020, people don't want to bother doing at their bathrooms because they don't need to wash because they're not going anywhere. They want to get out into the garden and put down a patio, or put, you know, fix a fence, or, you know, rebuild that wall. And the figures bear it out. This is what's been happening. And I find these numbers interesting.
Yes. Well, it does paint a picture, isn't it? You wouldn't expect to have such a concise picture painted for you by the Builders Merchants Federation. But it really does tell a story, doesn't it? I mean, certainly I've been more active in the garden, put it that way. I've had the tree surgeon round to lop a few branches off. I've had a retaining wall built with some stone gabions and stuff like that. And jobs which actually I have been putting off for about 2 or 3 years, finally got round to doing it this year. And it's partly because...
And I'm exactly the same. I've had concrete laid for a shed base. I've put up a shed. I've fixed fences. I've rebuilt walls. Same story. Not touch the kitchens or the bathrooms or any plumbing. Mind you, I need to get a plumbing. I've got a leaky washing machine, but that's another story.
But no, I think it's true. I suppose when we've been sort of confined to quarters for so long, haven't been able to go away on holiday, that kind of thing, people look at their own surroundings, their immediate surroundings, and they want to make them more enjoyable. And certainly during the summer, that means going out in the garden, if you have one, if you're lucky enough to have a garden. So I'm not at all surprised to hear this. I would have thought that perhaps the DIY outlets like B&Q and, you know, Homebase and people like that would have had a more extreme change in their fortunes. I don't know. But the fact that it's, you know, the builders merchants, is not just the DIYers, but it's also the trades which have been more active. Yeah, I think that's quite interesting.
Well, I've got a prediction to make. I reckon Q4, we're going to see kitchens and bathrooms, and Q1 next year, year on year, kitchens and bathrooms will shoot up because of all the stamp duty holiday. The housing market has taken off. A lot of people have bought, I was going to say new houses, new to them houses, old houses. And one of the first things that people, if they've got any money left, which maybe they will have from the stamp duty reduction,
yes,
will be putting in a new kitchen or a new bathroom. So I think I think you're absolutely right.
Yeah, yeah, absolutely. So, yeah, we'll look out for that one because I think that's a very sound prediction.
On which note, I need to get to my kitchen. I'm hungry. It's lunchtime, David.
So it is. Yes, we've been talking for far too long.
After our slightly truncated episode last week, we've prattled on a long time this week.
We have.
I hope we haven't bored too many of you, but if you've stayed to the end, you've obviously stuck with us. So thank you very much indeed. David and I will be back again as usual next week. In the meantime, do get in touch, podcast@theconstructionindex.co.uk. If you want to see more of those statistics on the Builders Merchant Federation sales, they're at theconstructionindex.co.uk, or you could just go to the Builders Merchant Federation site itself. They call it the BMBI. And anything else we've been talking about, it's all there at theconstructionindex.co.uk. And we'll be back next week. So from David and I, see ya.
Goodbye.
Thank you for listening to Reconstruction, the podcast from the Construction Index. To keep up to date with the latest construction news and headlines, please visit theconstructionindex.co.uk and sign up for our free daily email news briefing.